your daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when the March for Life had a huge crowd and it had the President of the United States. This year, and they've been doing the March for Life every year since 1974, right after Roe v. Wade. They've had messages from the president before, video messages. No president has gone there personally and directly. No vice president has gone there personally and directly, who while he's sitting in office, until Mike Pence went last year. So what did President Trump say? Did he speak about the impeachment trial going on? We will play some highlights of the president's brief remarks going to the March for Life today. We will also cover what I believe to be a brilliant new concept by one of America's most thoughtful conservatives and someone who agrees that impeachment is a mistake, it's a distraction, it's negative in terms of the way the Democrats are pursuing it. Adam Schiff is speaking once again. For those who have not had enough of Adam Schiff, they're plenty more opportunities because today the Democrats wrap up their 3 days of laying out their case. And now we're going to get 3 days next week of the president's defense team laying out their case. And Peggy Noonan says, and it's a remarkably smart idea, that the way to redeem this entire process, the way to make the entire thing feel like it wasn't a complete waste of time, to have some kind of resolution here, is to call witnesses. Yeah, and let the Democrats call three witnesses, the three that they really want. I think they really want John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney, and probably Michael Duffy would be the third witness. Maybe Mike Pompeo. Fine. What do they have to hide? Answer, probably nothing. And the fourth witness, we're also told, would have nothing to hide. His name would be Joe Biden. I actually think this is a brilliant suggestion. What I don't think is a brilliant suggestion is Joe Biden's idea of a public option. We're going to be speaking to Lani Chen, a former aide to Mitt Romney, and he's with the Hoover Institution now, about why the public option would bankrupt the country just maybe a little bit slower than Medicare for All. And there's also a big new movie that we're reviewing today. It's a movie with a very much an all-star cast. Hugh Grant, Matthew McConaughey is in it, Colin Farrell, and many more. It's about British gangsters, and it's completely politically incorrect and disgusting. But is it worth seeing? Well, that depends. Depends on what? We will get to that when we review The Gentleman, which is not at all what you think it might be, given the cast and the director and what have you. Okay, first up, Peggy Noonan. She has a piece coming out tomorrow in the Wall Street Journal, and she's begun talking about it in advance. And I think what she's saying, she was last night on with Chris Matthews. And I think what she was saying makes a lot of sense. The headline for the piece in the Journal that's going to appear tomorrow in the paper says, impeachment needs witnesses on both sides. And it says, forget Democrats and Republicans. The interests of a third party, history, are more important. In other words, the worst possible outcome in terms of impeachment for everybody, not just for Democrats, but yes, them too. So for the president, everybody else, would be after all this time and after all this effort and all of this attention and all this debate, if the thing felt unresolved, if there was a belief that there was more that was hiding in plain sight. And Peggy Noonan, I think, addresses that with a brilliant concept to cut through the nonsense. Listen.
4 days, the idea that you shouldn't elongate this thing weeks and months, of course, we have an election coming in 10 months. However, take 4 days, have four witnesses. Who should they be? three big fact witnesses, Mick Mulvaney, John Bolton, Rudy Giuliani, and somebody else, maybe not a fact witness, not involved in this crazy scheme, in fact, the victim of it, but Joe Biden, a longtime government official, a man of poise. He knows the U.S. Senate. He was there for 36 years. Let him come forward and answer questions that the Republicans might have about Ukraine, about the familial drama, about the whole thing. Let it go. My feeling is, be generous to history. Give it the information it needs. It's hungry for data. It wants to know the entire story. For the Democrats, witnesses would lift this whole proceeding into a new level. For the Republicans, not only being generous to history, but I have to say, it's almost impossible to think the president is going to be convicted with the needed 67 votes in the Republican Senate. So the Republicans feel they're going to win. Therefore, A, be generous and gracious about it, but B, give some cover to your own senators who are running for re-election, who don't want to be tainted with the stigma of, sure, you won, but you won by not letting anybody come in and talk. Let everybody come in and talk. Let the whole thing, let it all hit the wall. My feeling is go for it, then end this thing in the way that I think we all know it is going to end.
And politically, just the last point, which grabbed me, which was you believe that if Joe Biden, well, he'd take a risk, of course, but he could win the presidency on this, or certainly the nomination if he is a starring witness.
It's a real opportunity, oddly enough. It is high risk, high reward. Joe Biden showed up, and in a day of testimony and Q&A, if he showed up and bobbled it or seemed not equal to the moment or not to be able to answer the questions, that would be very bad for him. But if he shows up and he brings it to President Trump and he accuses him of abusing American civil servants who were just trying to do their jobs but weren't in on this scheme and so they had to be crushed like the U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine. If he makes a case, if he is stirring, wow, he could make himself president that day. So it's very high risk, high reward, but heck, he's okay. In politics. Go for it.
Are you joking? Is this a joke?
No, it's not a joke. I think it's a brilliant idea. And let me tell you why. I tweeted this morning, and you can follow us on Twitter, by the way. It's Medved Show on Twitter, at Medved Show on Twitter. In any event, I tweeted this morning about the inherent contradiction in this case that the Democrats are making over and over and over and over again. They started using the term during the impeachment trial of cheated, that the president cheated in the election. And what they mean by that is that they believe that when they use the term cheated, or they talk about the president asking Ukraine to interfere in our election, they are suggesting that somehow announcing an investigation of Joe Biden and of his son, Hunter Biden, would be so devastating, would have so much influence on the campaign, it would change the outcome. It would mean that he wasn't elected fairly if the president does win re-election. It would mean that he actually used the investigation of Joe Biden as a political tool to obliterate his most formidable opponent. But see, that contradicts something else we hear endlessly from the Democrats and from mainstream media, and something else that I believe to be true. I agree with their assumption that Joe Biden has no direct evidence of culpability or of wrongdoing. He's been looked at not only by various press agencies, but by various government agencies here in the United States. Joe Biden did not handle the situation badly in Ukraine. And by the way, it is not true what some Republican hacks, and yes, I will say hacks, say, that Joe Biden got a prosecutor fired who was investigating Burisma. He got a prosecutor fired that everybody, Republican, Democrat, on every side believed was corrupt and who was not investigating anything, which is why they wanted Shokin to be fired. It was an obvious call, and that was the right thing to do. And that's something that they can ask Biden about in the Senate if he's a witness at the trial, because he is being accused, and you know you're going to hear lots and lots and lots of it from the president's defense team. Well, why is it that Joe Biden can go ahead and say we're going to hold up aid until you fire a prosecutor, but it's not allowed for President Trump? And the answer would be because there was no political consideration, some means of destroying an opponent or of having a firing of a prosecutor or interfering with Ukrainian domestic affairs having some kind of political benefit directly for Biden or for the United States. Now, there would be if it was true that that prosecutor was investigating Burisma. So let it come out clearly so the whole world, so the whole country knows that that was not the case. And look, I think that it's one of those things that Democrats should welcome and should allow them to clarify the inherent contradiction in their position. In other words, if Joe Biden is innocent of any wrongdoing, then how would it be that somehow initiating an investigation of him would be such a decisive step in this political process? How would that amount to cheating unless there is something to hide? And I honestly believe it will probably turn out that there isn't. And if there is, then we darn well better know about it because very relevant to this impeachment trial. 1-800-955-1776, our phone number. Ted Cruz, I think when he was talking about this, he made the point that the Democrats in their presentation have tried preemptively to basically clear Joe and Hunter Biden of any wrongdoing. In other words, what you can't clear is Hunter Biden taking money for a position for which he was not qualified does seem extraordinarily dubious. Is it illegal? No, it's not illegal. Did it need some kind of investigation for that to come out to the public? No, it's been out for the public for a long time. And I think it's very dubious. And I have not heard any specific defense or explanation of why it was Hunter Biden got that money. But the point being that Senator Cruz says that, look, the Democrats brought the Bidens up. And this means, yes, they are suddenly very relevant to this case and they should be called as witnesses. Could Ted Cruz be agreeing with Peggy Noonan on this? Listen.
Adam Schiff's arguments to open the day today directly drew into question Hunter Biden and made not only his testimony relevant, which it already was, but it is now critical because the House Democrats have built their entire case on the proposition that any investigation into Burisma and corruption was a sham, that it was completely debunked. The problem is there is very significant prima facie evidence of corruption. Hunter Biden, the son of the then sitting president, Joe Biden, was being
Vice
paid
president.
$83,000 a month, $1 million a year. This is someone with no background in oil and gas, no experience. And at the same time, Joe Biden has publicly admitted that he threatened Ukraine. He threatened to withhold $1 billion of aid unless and until Ukraine fired the prosecutor that was potentially investigating the company on which his son served on the board. If the House manager's case is based on the allegations of corruption concerning Hunter Biden and Joe Biden being a sham, then it is directly relevant. And I got to say, the need for the Senate to hear the testimony of Hunter Biden and the need for the Senate to grant the White House lawyers the ability to take that testimony has become all the more relevant. Representative Nadler threw up great indignation. And he said, out of hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian companies, how can it be that President Trump was just concerned with this one company, Burisma? Well, the obvious answer that the House managers ignore is Burisma was the only Ukrainian company that had the son of the vice president that had real prima facie indications of American corruption. We're not talking about some abstract interest in any sort of corruption that might exist in Ukraine, but if you have a sitting vice president making public policy decisions to benefit his family to the tune of $1 million a year, that raises a serious question of corruption, and a president not only is justified in asking for that to be investigated, but has a responsibility to see that that's investigated. And that was a question not about Ukrainian corruption, but a question about American corruption and Ukraine being integral in helping investigate whether there was, in fact, American corruption. I think we're going to hear another 2.5 days of arguments from the House Democrats. But the longer they talk at this point, the weaker the case is getting.
Okay, that obviously we're winding up. We're concluding our third day from the Democrats. Note that what Senator Cruz said is he said he wanted to have a prosecutor who was potentially investigating Burisma. At least that's more careful than some other things that Republicans have said that I think are utterly irresponsible. There is no reason to believe that the prosecutor who Biden and the official U.S. government policy was to get him fired because he was associated with the old corrupt pro-Putin Ukrainian regime, that when Biden was pushing very hard and very publicly, not behind the scenes, but very publicly talked about it to get this guy fired, it was not because of his investigations or his prosecutions or his digging into Burisma or anything else. It was because he was associated with precisely those same kind of corrupt interests. Now, look, I do believe that part of the difficulty that you have here is a difficulty with language. There are two words which the Democrats have begun using again and again and again and again and again that honestly change everything. And they're inappropriate considering the situation and considering the evidence that actually is before us. The two words are, I mentioned before, cheated and interference with our election. In other words, if Ukraine announces an investigation of something that may merit investigation, how is that interference with an American election? And you can say all you want that, wait a minute, President Trump wasn't concerned about corruption in Ukraine in general. And that's probably true. He certainly expressed no general concerns about corruption when he was talking to Zelensky. He basically wanted his own conspiracy theory about CrowdStrike and the Hillary Clinton server and Ukraine being involved in the 2016 election. But to talk about that is not to ask them to cheat. It's not to ask them to interfere in our election. Because if you believe, and Democrats do, and I think they are going to have the grounds to prove it if they call Joe Biden as a witness, if you believe that Joe Biden was not involved in any corrupt activities in Ukraine, then how would that amount to cheating? How would it amount to interference in a U.S. election? And this goes to the entire problem with the entire Mueller charge to begin with. Did Russia try to interfere in our election? Absolutely. Did Russian interference actually change the outcome in the election? I don't know any serious person who believes that it did. I know it can be a Democratic campaign cry at times. One of the other Democratic campaign cries is Medicare for all, or Medicare for all who want it. That's the Pete Buttigieg, Joe Biden idea, Medicare for all who want it. But if you do that, you're going to bankrupt the country big time and force a rise in taxes. Who says so? We'll be speaking to Dr. Lanny Chin of the Hoover Institution about the dangers of a public option. Coming up on the MedVent Show. On the Michael Medved Show, let me welcome back a friend and a friend of the show. Dr. Lonnie Chen is the David and Diane Steffi Fellow in American Public Policy Studies. Boy, that's a long title. At the Hoover Institution, he is also a director of domestic policy studies and a lecturer at Stanford University. And Lonnie is also the author of a very, very important column that just appeared this morning in the Wall Street Journal. And just to set the stage, for people who are paying any attention at all, there's been a hot debate on the Democratic side of things between those people who favor Medicare for all and people who favor what Pete Buttigieg calls Medicare for all who want it, which would be a public option. In other words, expanding Obamacare massively to provide some kind of public insurance for people who wanted to go that route. So, Lonnie, you, I think, sound the warning that while this suggestion sounds reasonable and moderate, there's something intensely dangerous about it. What's that?
Well, yes, Michael, good to be with you again. The challenge in creating a public option, it sounds eminently reasonable to give people a choice to join this government-run plan if they don't want a private health insurance plan. The challenge is when you give the government the opportunity to step in the way that Mr. Buttigieg and Mr. Bloomberg and Mr. Biden, all three of whom support this, when you allow for that, what you do is you end up creating a monster. You create a plan that will enroll one in three Americans by the time we get to the mid-2020s, and will also end up costing taxpayers an awful lot of money, because the reality is that, first of all, politicians can't resist the notion of paying providers more to participate in the program. But furthermore, they also can't resist the notion of trying to hold premiums down in the public option by making taxpayers foot the bill for the difference. So the point of the piece basically is for a solution that sounds moderate, we estimate that over the first 10 years, it's going to cost about $700 billion. But the bigger challenge is over the 30-year window, it ends up becoming the third largest government program behind Medicare and Social Security, outpacing even spending on defense. So there are a lot of warning signs to something that sounds moderate to start with.
Are you suggesting that Medicare doesn't pay for itself?
No. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. If you go back to the history of the Medicare program, when Part B of Medicare, so Medicare's got many parts. Part B is the part that covers doctor's visits. It's called supplemental medical insurance in the technical parlance. When that was first created, the idea was, well, look, we're going to have premiums that cover costs, and we're going to see if we can keep those premiums under control. But the challenge is, within just a few years, Congress had to intervene essentially to help pay for the benefit. And it all of these programs start with the intention of being self-sufficient, but over time, they never are. And so that's the lesson we've got to learn when we think about this public option.
Okay, the numbers that you bring up in your piece, which is based on research, extensive research done at the Hoover Institution, really do show that the only the inevitable result of instituting a public option would be a very, very sharp rise in Medicare taxes. And that would not be a rise on the super-duper wealthy. It would be a rise on everybody, right?
Yeah, I think this is an important point, Michael, which is that a lot of folks on the left want to argue, well, look, we can pay for all this by increasing taxes on the rich. And this has become a little bit of a siren song that you hear repeated over and over again on the left.
2% wealth tax, as Elizabeth Warren likes to talk about.
A tax on hedge fund managers or this, that, and the other. Well, what we find is that it is impossible, not literally impossible, but certainly procedurally impossible, to impose enough of a tax increase on the wealthiest Americans to pay for all of this spending. And so what you end up having to do is one of a few different options. And two that we point out are, if you wanted to, let's say, distribute the tax increase more broadly, then it means middle-income families are going to see an increase in their income tax rate. So that's not good. So the other alternative is, well, we'll put in place a tax similar to what you've already got now in the form of the payroll tax that helps pay for Medicare Part A, which is the hospitalization part of Medicare. If you wanted to put in place that kind of a tax that would tax essentially all wages and all income, you're looking at about a 5% tax by the time we get to 2049. And that's on all of the wages and all of the income from every single American. So this is really going to get out of control pretty quickly.
And again, what would that mean? A typical American household now earns about $60,000 a year. Is that right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So what would that mean for that kind of household?
Well, it could mean that they would be seeing an income tax rate increase of about 6 percentage points. So if you go from, let's say you pay 28% in taxes now, you're going to 34% on the margin. So you're talking about probably at least a few extra $1,000 a year.
Yeah, it was 6% of 60 grand. That alone is what, $3,600, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's now the way our income tax system works. You're talking about the tax on the margin. But yeah, it's still a couple thousand bucks probably. It's
okay,
not chump change.
So President Trump and Republican Senate candidates can say, wait a minute, hold on. This Medicare for all who want it idea is really a Trojan horse and it's really a sham. But we have a better idea for expanding insurance coverage and keeping insurance costs down. And that idea is ... Your answer,
well,
Dr. Chen.
So there's a few ways of handling this. One is we've got to focus on how we decrease cost. And the biggest challenge for decreasing cost, and here's a problem, Michael, I'll just say broadly. Conservatives do not have a bumper sticker answer to this healthcare problem. Liberals do. They say, well, look, just expand government programs. The answer on the right is much more nuanced, but it goes to the fundamental issue of there not being enough transparency in healthcare costs. So we don't actually know as consumers of healthcare how much we spend. We know what our copays are. We know what we've got to pay when we go to the doctor, but we don't know how much that healthcare actually costs. And in the absence of that information, costs will continue to increase over time. So what we've got to do is A, figure out a way to get people more information about the healthcare they're consuming. And then B, give people more freedom and flexibility over how they spend their healthcare dollars. Things like health savings accounts, plans that offer a variety of different insurance benefits instead of saying, hey, we, the federal government, are going to offer you just one kind of health insurance and you're going to like that kind of health insurance whether you need those benefits or not. More choice, more optionality, and more transparency. Those, I think, are the hallmarks of a plan that will bring down costs and increase access to health care.
Can you try to reduce it to a bumper sticker?
Boy, more choice, more competition, less cost.
Okay,
that's how I would put it.
Which, by the way, is something that we desperately need. And this, by the way, illustrates one of my most important points that, honestly, I want to be talking about virtually every day, which is that regardless of what happens in the presidential election, where President Trump looks like an increasingly likely winner, it's crucial to hold the U.S. Senate, which is going to be a fierce fight, and to take back the House. And when you ask people what their number one issue is when it comes to questions about how you're going to vote for the Senate, how you're going to vote for the House, they say medical care again and again and again, health care. They don't say impeachment one way or another. Alani's piece is well worth reading. It's in the Wall Street Journal today. The myth of the moderate, in quotes, public option. Alani Chen, keep the information and enlightenment coming along. When we come back, there's an argument as to who should pick the next president. Lindsey Graham has something to say about that. We'll hear what he has to say and an encounter he had this morning. That and more coming up on The MedVed Show.
Your daily dose of debate.
I'm a huge fan of your show. I almost never agree with you.
The Michael MedVed Show.
And on The Michael MedVed Show, we'll go to your calls in just a moment. 1-800-955-1776, our phone number. I mentioned that Lindsey Graham was speaking this morning. And he formulated the very essence of his very, very intense opposition to this whole drive to impeach President Trump. Here's what he had to say.
I have said consistently, I'm not going to grant witness requests by the defense. They could have called all of these people if they'd wanted them in the House. They denied the president his day in court, and I'm not going to legitimize that. There are a bunch of people on my side who want to call Joe Biden and Hunter Biden. I want to end this thing sooner rather than later. I don't want to turn it into a circus. I think Schumer said yesterday, we're not willing to trade Joe Biden for anybody. I think I know why. I want the American people to pick the next president, not me. And so what I think is the best thing to happen is to have oversight of Ukrainian potential misconduct and move on to the election. I am not going to use my vote to extend the trial.
And what he's saying is he despite the fact that there are many Republicans who feel that Joe Biden or Hunter Biden or both of them, maybe the two of them together, should be witnesses before the impeachment trial, Lindsey Graham says no. Let us go to David in Seattle. David, you're on the Michael Medved Show.
Hey, Mike, I think you and Peggy are a little crazy wanting more witnesses. We already have the witnesses in the House, and Pelosi and Schiff and Nadler, everyone on MSNBC said it's a slam dunk case already.
No, so and it's clear.
They have said that. They've been saying that.
I understand. I understand. And it's we've talked on the air. That's the one of the contradictions in their case, one of many. And they say, yeah, we have all the evidence we need. We have a mountain of evidence. And then they say we need more evidence. Now, it's one or the other. And the truth is they need more evidence because right now it's very, very clear how people are going to vote. And they never have heard from John Bolton or from Mick Mulvaney or from Rudy Giuliani, for that matter. And I think that Peggy Noonan is right that when you're talking about the bar of history, in other words, other than the desire not to drag this out further, what's the argument against having John Bolton, who said he is willing to testify, come up there and testify?
I'll tell you. You could give the Democrats 100 days and 100 witnesses, and on the 101st day, you think they'll say, oh, that Mitch McConnell, he's very reasonable, and we appreciate the way he's handling this.
No, of course not, but that's not the deal. That's the point, is what Peggy is talking about, is making a deal. Is, okay.
There's no deal. They're always going to want more.
Okay, I'm sure they'll want more, and then you have the votes to vote it down. And that's the point.
And you'll go 3 months doing this.
No, I
have to go.
Again, a part of what you vote on would be a time restraint. And by the way, Schumer's talked about this today, too. For the Democrats, they don't want to extend this. I mean, it's certainly not helpful for Joe Biden or for their nomination process, for goodness sake. I mean, it is today. It's 10 days from the Iowa caucuses. It's less than that. Is that less than that? It is. Oh, it is 10 days. Okay. 10 days until the Iowa caucuses. That's very direct. And right now, I mean, there are lots of Democrats who are truly concerned, I mean, deeply concerned about the idea of Bernie Sanders, who the most extreme candidate, the one candidate that I think any reasonable person would look at and say he is completely unelectable, and he should be, Piers Morgan wrote a powerful piece over in the UK that actually goes very directly to why this entire process has been so helpful for President Trump so far. He's over in Davos talking about a great economy. He speaks today at the March for Life. He next week is going to be kicking off, apparently, his peace plan for the Middle East. And he is inviting both Prime Minister Netanyahu and the leader of the Israeli opposition, his main rival, Benny Gantz, to the White House to talk about that. So, again, President Trump is gaining every day that this continues. And I think that the idea that somehow the Democrats get helped by extending it with witnesses is an incorrect assumption. In any event, the part of the situation that we have right now is I want to follow up on the story we covered intensively yesterday, which is this shooting in Seattle. Because yesterday, at the time we were on the air, we only knew about two suspects. Well, there were three. The latest report, one suspect was arrested and two others remain on the run in the downtown Seattle shooting Wednesday night that killed a woman and hurt seven other people, including a nine-year-old boy. Police say all three suspects are known gang members and the shooting was gang-related. We know that we have two suspects that were in front of the McDonald's and some sort of dispute occurred with a third person being there. Guns were pulled, shots were fired, people were running, and the subjects fled from each other. And that's what Carmen Best, the police chief, said. Best said overnight, last night, officers recovered a tremendous amount of physical and digital evidence. That was Wednesday night, actually, including multiple shell casings from the three different caliber of firearms. The suspects still at large are Marquise Latrell Tolbert, who's 24, and William Ray Tolliver, who's 24. And the other suspect, who is in custody, is a Jamal Lionel Jackson, who's 21. He was one of the shooters, according to the police chief. He was also, and this is something we didn't know yesterday, one of the eight people who were shot. In other words, police said Jackson was arrested on a firearms violation in connection with a shooting because he possessed a gun at the scene. He was booked into jail at 10:19 p.m. Wednesday after he was released from Harborview Medical Center with his gunshot wounds. His bail was set at $50,000. I have no idea why it's this low. Police said Jackson admitted to having a gun during Wednesday's shooting, and they were corroborating that with video evidence that showed Jackson with a gun in his hand. Jackson's criminal history includes robbery convictions, a misdemeanor harassment conviction, and two prior convictions for unlawful handgun possession. Okay, if you have two priors for unlawful handgun possession, and if you are a criminal and a career criminal and gang member, known gang member as this individual is, isn't it clear that what we need is not more gun laws, but more enforcement of laws that exist today? And the idea, why only $50,000 for this guy who was involved in a shooting where somebody died? In a 2017 guilty plea, Jackson said he was not a gang member, but police that year said he was a known gang member. Who are you going to believe here? They outlined his alleged gang ties in court documents, and prosecutors wrote that Jackson is, quote, likely to commit a violent offense. Prosecutors wrote that after Jackson was arrested for being a felon in possession of a handgun outside the same McDonald's on 3rd Avenue and Pine Street where yesterday's shooting happened. Okay, this is Wednesday's shooting. This is the entire thing is completely nuts. If you have a guy who is now going back to the same place where he was arrested before for having a gun that he shouldn't have, honestly, there could be, don't you think, more law enforcement focus, not just by police, but by prosecutors, on going after firearms falling into the hands of known career criminals, letting career criminals run loose for any reason. Coming up, the president today made history, the first president ever to speak to the March for Life. What did he have to say? We'll play you highlights. His speech was not covered on most major networks. It should be. It was important. And we also have an important, well, we have a movie to review. That and more on The Medved Show.
This is producer rock star Greg with the Michael Medved.